If you think the ultimate goal of starting a company is to finally become your own boss, you are operating under a pretty massive delusion.
Oh, absolutely. It's the biggest myth out there.
Right, because the reality is, as a CEO, you aren't really the boss of anything. You are basically a full-time professional beggar and, like, an enforcer.
Yeah, you're going to spend over half your waking hours asking people for money just to keep the lights on.
Mm.
Or aggressively demanding it from people who haven't paid you.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today, we are bringing you some really fascinating excerpts from The CEO's Compass, perspectives on leadership, negotiation, and advice. And our mission today is to completely dismantle the hidden emotional, psychological, and practical hurdles of leadership.
And negotiation, too. The art of asking for help, which is way harder than it sounds.
Oh, for sure. By the time we finish tearing these concepts apart, you are going to view the act of asking for funding and setting boundaries around your own expertise in a completely different light.
It really requires a radical reframing of what it actually takes to survive when you're sitting in the big chair. I mean, it is not about raw technical skill. It's about mastering the human element under, like, extreme duress.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the source text starts by attacking this whole illusion of self-reliance right out of the gate. Before we even touch the tactical mechanics of running a business, we have to look at the psychological baseline of someone seeking help.
Yeah, the text specifically looks at founders entering high-pressure startup accelerators.
Yeah.
You know, those intensive boot camps where early-stage companies try to get seed money.
Right. And the baseline emotional state in those places is just, it's incredibly fraught.
It is. The author notes that when founders arrive looking for help, they are frequently in a state of deep stress or even outright desperation. They feel like they're at the absolute end of their rope.
And as a defense mechanism, they frequently make this sweeping, dramatic claim, which is, I have only ever been able to rely on myself.
Which, you know, sounds incredibly heroic in a movie script.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're in the trenches, working 100-hour weeks, missing your family, you can completely understand why a founder feels that isolated.
You can absolutely feel the weight of it.
Yeah.
But the source provides a really fascinating and frankly necessary reality check to that mindset.
It calls them out.
Totally.
Right.
That claim of absolute self-reliance, it's a complete fabrication. It completely ignores the fundamental infrastructure of human existence.
I mean, before you could even fend for yourself, you were kept warm in the winter.
Right. You were given water and food, clothed, sheltered, educated by the efforts of countless other people.
The text points out this staggering historical perspective. If you are living in modern Western society, you are currently living a better, longer, healthier life than anyone other than a king or their immediate royal family lived just 10 generations ago.
Yeah, and to drive that point home, the author throws in a slightly misquoted line from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, which is, "The fault is not in our stars, but in ourselves."
Which is a heavy thing to hear when you're stressed.
It is, but the underlying message is critical. The crushing stress you're feeling isn't necessarily because the universe is conspiring against you. It is often a direct product of your own flawed, isolated perspective.
And holding on to that flawed perspective is incredibly dangerous when you look at what a CEO actually does all day. Because the source drops a stark definition of the job that completely reframes the power dynamic.
I love this part.
It says, an employee gets paid to do a job. But a CEO's job is to get them paid.
That distinction changes everything. It moves the CEO from being the chief creator to being the chief resource gatherer.
Exactly. The text estimates that more than 50% of a CEO's time is ultimately spent asking other people for money or, you know, chasing down invoices.
And it explicitly says, if you cannot cope with that reality, you should not be a CEO.
It makes me think about how we usually visualize leadership. We think of a CEO as the captain steering the ship, but really a CEO is more like the fuel pump on a massive engine.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Right. The entire machine relies on you pulling in resources. If you hate pumping gas, you have absolutely no business sitting in the driver's seat. But let me push back on this slightly.
Sure.
Is it really just about the money? Or is the money acting as a proxy for validating the founder's vision?
What's fascinating here is that the author addresses this exact nuance. Yes, almost everyone coming to an accelerator is looking for cash. But the money itself isn't the terminal goal.
Right. It's a means to an end.
It's merely the tool they need to execute their ambition. Whether a founder is just scraping by to make payroll, or they're already wealthy and trying to scale a product to do more good, the money just enables the vision.
So the money is the fuel, not the actual destination.
Precisely. And that's why that historical perspective shift, realizing your baseline life is fundamentally better than royalty, is a mandatory survival mechanism.
You have to have that gratitude.
You do. If you walk into those relentless fundraising conversations with a massive chip on your shoulder, genuinely believing the world owes you a check, you will live in constant agonizing stress.
Yeah, you have to appreciate the baseline reality of your environment just to insulate your mind from the immense pressure of the role.
And that insulation is vital, because spending half your life asking people to open their wallets naturally leads to intense emotional friction.
Oh, no doubt. And paradoxically, even though you are constantly talking to investors and clients, the texts point out that it leads to a profound, crushing sense of isolation.
The old cliche holds entirely true. It really is lonely at the top. The text validates this as a core feature of the job.
Because the buck stops with you.
Exactly. You are fundamentally alone with the ultimate consequences of every decision.
Though the source adds one very funny caveat.
Oh, right, the billionaire exception.
Yeah. Unless you happen to be the famous CEO of a billion-dollar publicly traded company, in that case, you are never left alone.
Which introduces a totally different nightmare of constant surveillance and public scrutiny.
A completely different pathology. But for the vast majority of leaders building companies, the isolation is deafening.
And because of this isolation, compounded by the constant need to negotiate, the source identifies a non-negotiable skill. You have to learn to think of emotional responses in a non-emotional way.
Okay, parsing an emotional response in a non-emotional way, that sounds great on a bumper sticker, but how does someone actually execute that when their stress is through the roof?
You do it by anchoring on data rather than internal feelings. It is a very common trap. When most people negotiate, especially under the threat of failure, they focus entirely on their own emotions.
Like how the interaction makes them feel.
Right. If an investor frowns, the founder feels rejected and gets defensive. But the vital skill is shifting that focus entirely onto understanding the emotions of the other party as an objective puzzle to be solved.
You have to treat their hesitation as a data point, not a personal attack.
That analytical detachment is key. The source makes it clear that you aren't ignoring emotions. The emotions in the room are the most vital components of the negotiation.
But you have to view them analytically.
Exactly. You have to pause your own internal monologue long enough to truly understand things from their perspective. It's not just listening to the words they're saying.
It's observing their physiological cues, right? Understanding the market context they're operating in.
Grasping why they are thinking what they are thinking.
And the text specifically notes that this is a distinctly human advantage. It points out that this level of empathetic analysis is something even artificial intelligence cannot do today.
No, not at all.
An AI language model might be able to read a transcript of a negotiation and summarize the meaning of the words, but it cannot grasp the underlying messy human why that drives an investor to withhold funding out of fear.
Or a client to push for a discount out of insecurity. Because the why is rooted in deeply human contexts.
Right. Prior failures, career ambitions, irrational fears, thing an algorithm simply hasn't lived through.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Oh, tell me.
Because if you are sitting in that CEO chair right now, let's say you have exactly 60 days of runway left, meaning in 2 months, the bank account hits zero and you have to lay off your entire team.
Nightmare scenario.
You are pitching an investor. You are desperate. How on earth do you functionally separate your own screaming, visceral need for that funding from an objective, analytical reading of the investor sitting across the table?
That's almost impossible. It's the hardest thing to do in business.
Which is why it is the defining filter for successful leadership. If you fail to separate those two things, your desperation inevitably colors your interpretation of reality.
You project your own anxiety onto them.
And you get their perspective completely wrong. And the source warns about the immediate fatal consequence of this. If you misinterpret investors' hesitation and you reflect that misunderstanding back to them in your response,
the illusion of your competence is broken instantly.
Instantly. They immediately realize, this person has no idea what I actually care about.
And once that happens, the cycle spirals. They get the wrong impression of your leadership. They pull back further. Your panic increases. And the relationship fractures permanently.
Why does this matter so much? Because mastering your own emotional baseline is the absolute prerequisite for seeing the chessboard clearly.
If you are blinded by your own panic about the 60-day runway, you cannot anticipate the investor's moves.
You cannot see the structural reasons why they are hesitating, and you cannot adjust your strategy to actually solve their problem, so they'll write the check.
So, if the core problem is being isolated at the top, and the challenge is maintaining analytical detachment in high-stakes emotional situations, the logical solution is to bring an outside perspective.
Right. Get an advisor.
Get someone who isn't drowning in the day-to-day operations to look at the chessboard with you. But our source warns that founders frequently botch this relationship completely, too.
They absolutely do. And it almost always stems from fundamentally misunderstanding the nature of what help actually looks like.
Absolutely.
The text states that when leaders sign up for an individual advisor or assemble an advisory board, they often treat it like a transactional vending machine for networking.
Ah, like just paying someone to open up their Rolodex of rich contacts.
Far from it. They miss the most profound psychological role that advisor plays. A truly good advisor fundamentally alters the geometry of the CEO's isolation.
You are no longer alone out there against the world.
The author describes the ideal dynamic as being akin to a friendship. Now, obviously, you cannot contractually mandate friendship in a consulting agreement.
No, the lawyers would have a field day trying to enforce a best friends forever clause.
The underlying dynamic, however, requires a genuine mutual fit. The CEO needs to look beyond just what resources they can extract from the relationship and deeply consider what the advisor is getting out of the exchange emotionally and intellectually.
And the source is incredibly blunt on this point. If the advisor is in the room just for the equity or the cash retainer, do not engage them.
Because a purely transactional relationship won't hold up under extreme pressure. When the company hits a wall and the runway drops to zero, a mercenary advisor will just walk away.
Which leads directly to this incredibly tragic, I told you so anecdote detailed in the text.
Oh, this story. It serves as a painful textbook case study in the psychology of refusing practical help.
So the author talks about a CEO who initiated a conversation about bringing them on as an advisor, but the CEO ultimately balked, deciding, nope, I'm going to go it alone.
And that founder proceeds to burn through their cash reserves for 9 solid months.
Unbelievable.
And then, only when the absolute worst-case scenario arrives, when they have less than 60 days of runway left, they come crawling back asking for the author's help.
By which point, the hull of the ship is fundamentally breached.
The author notes they still tried to help identify ways to slow the bleeding, looking for desperate maneuvers to survive long enough to reach cash flow neutral.
Which is the point where the company brings in exactly as much as it spends.
Right. But the core tragedy was examining why this CEO burned cash for 9 months in isolation.
Why did they?
They were operating on the vague, ego-driven fantasy that some magical angel investor would eventually swoop in from the heavens and validate their genius with a massive check.
Wow. They refused the practical grounding advice available 9 months earlier because it probably meant making hard, unglamorous choices.
And instead, held out for a fantasy.
The text actually brings up the classic parable of the flood to illustrate this psychological blind spot. And for anyone familiar with the story, it maps perfectly onto the startup world.
It really does.
A man is drowning in a flood, he refuses a ride from an ATV, and later refuses to get into a rescue boat, telling everyone, God will save me.
Right, the classic joke.
Finally, he's on his roof, the water is at his neck, and he waves off a rescue helicopter, insisting on divine intervention. He drowns, goes to heaven, and asks God why he wasn't saved.
And God says, I sent you an ATV, a boat, and a helicopter.
Founders do this exact same thing. They reject the practical advisor, they ignore the bridge loan with tough terms because they are waiting for a mythical billionaire to rescue them on a golden term sheet.
It is the ultimate manifestation of ego destroying a company. They refuse a life preserver because it isn't the exact color they wanted.
Exactly.
The author explicitly links this behavior to the proverb, "The Lord helps those who help themselves." You cannot stubbornly refuse a genuine offer of help on reasonable market rate terms and then come back crying 9 months later that the ecosystem didn't support you.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, what we are really talking about is the mechanics of trust.
That's it.
The author makes this explicit. If you cannot establish trust, you cannot intake the external perspective you need to survive. You drown on the roof.
But, and here's the razor's edge that founders have to walk. If you overtrust, or if you leave yourself completely open without boundaries, you get exploited.
That overtrust is exactly what leaves a founder vulnerable. Because once you let your guard down to accept help, you inevitably invite in actors who will probe your boundaries to see what they can extract for free.
Which is why the author emphasizes that knowing how to accept health must be paired with knowing how to build a fortress around your own time and expertise.
You have to know how to protect yourself from bad exchanges. And the author shares a brilliant real-world anecdote about this from their work as an expert witness.
Oh, the lawyer's story.
Yes. If you don't know, being an expert witness is highly lucrative, but getting the big involves interviewing with legal teams to prove your expertise.
Right.
So the author does this standard one-hour free interview with a group of lawyers.
A completely standard professional courtesy. You give a sample of your thinking to prove competence.
Right. At the end, handshakes all around, everyone says thank you, and the author assumes they'll either get a contract or a rejection. But a few days later, these lawyers come back and they aren't offering a contract.
Instead, they're asking for lots of highly specific additional details. They want more of the author's analysis.
And the author instantly recognizes the psychological game being played. The lawyers were using that initial free interview and the follow-up questions to quietly crowdsource their legal strategy without paying for it.
It is human nature to push for free value until a hard boundary is set.
They were trying to extract the oxygen without paying for the tank. So what was the author's response to this? Two incredibly powerful words, pens down.
Pens down.
The free sample phase has officially concluded. If those lawyers want one more ounce of strategic insight, they have to officially retain the author as a paid consultant.
It is such a definitive structural boundary. But what is truly masterful about this anecdote is how that boundary was communicated.
Right. They didn't just yell at them.
No, the author didn't just fire off a self-righteous, angry email to the legal team. They utilized a third-party channel partner to deliver the harsh news.
For those who might not use them, a channel partner is essentially an intermediary or an agency that connects consultants with clients. And using them here is such a strategic move.
Very smart.
By having the channel partner play the bad cop and enforce the financial boundary, the author protects their direct intellectual relationship with the potential client.
It's like having an agent in Hollywood. You get to remain the visionary creative while your agent does the dirty work of demanding the money.
The author even notes that the channel partner likely didn't say anything as blunt as, he's not working for free anymore. They probably used softer corporate diplomacy, but the structural outcome was achieved.
It's one of the primary reasons the author uses intermediaries in the first place. It acts as an emotional heat shield. It absorbs the friction of the negotiation, so the primary relationship remains collaborative.
Makes total sense.
Now, the source does acknowledge that there are well-known, highly documented psychological tactics used in negotiations by the best in the field. But it warns that actively deploying manipulative tactics is almost always a trap.
Ultimately, long-term success doesn't come from psychological tricks. It depends on sound judgment. And specifically, making bets and setting boundaries without ever having all the information.
Because you never truly know what the other side's absolute bottom line is.
Precisely. The text emphasizes a core law of negotiation. Rational actors will only provide a certain amount of information and tolerate a certain amount of friction before they simply walk away.
They will not broadcast their breaking point until you have already crossed it.
So what does this all mean? If you have to be this guarded, if you have to use channel partners as heat shields and constantly monitor when to yell pens down, isn't there a massive risk of coming off as deeply cynical?
Like you are just moving through the business world, constantly bracing for someone to exploit your time.
Yeah, exactly.
It is not cynicism. It is a profound respect for the reality of the exchange. This brings us back to a recurring fundamental theme in the text, summarized perfectly by the closing thought. You can lead a horse to water, but you cannot make it drink.
That's a great way to frame it.
You have to set the precise terms of your value. You have to offer the exchange clearly and professionally. And if the other side will not meet your terms, whether as a stubborn founder refusing your advice because they want an angel investor or a team of lawyers trying to crowdsource free labor, you must have the discipline to walk away without emotional residue.
It is about clarity of value, not cynicism. Let's recap the journey we've taken today. We started by tearing down the persistent, romantic illusion of the self-made, solitary leader and confronted the hard, mechanical truth that a CEO's primary function is acquiring capital to keep the engine running.
We explored the vital, non-obvious necessity of managing your own internal emotional baseline, utilizing data and physiological cues so you can accurately diagnose the emotions and motivations of others in high-stakes environments.
We dissected the power of finding a true advisor who alters the geometry of your isolation, and the fatal danger of letting your ego wait for a magical rescue helicopter while your cash runway burns down to zero.
And finally, we looked at the absolute structural importance of setting boundaries, knowing your exact worth, and having the discipline to declare pens down before you are exploited.
It is a comprehensive, unsentimental look at the unseen mechanics of leadership. And for those listening who might be actively navigating these exact treacherous waters right now, the source material notes that the author actually hosts free advisory calls.
Oh, that's right.
They are typically held on the first and third Thursday of most months at 0900 Pacific time. It is a structured opportunity to share your situation and learn from the friction others are experiencing.
Consider that an actual practical life preserver being thrown your way.
Yeah.
And remember the parable, don't complain to the universe if you refuse to catch it.
But before we wrap up this deep dive, we want to leave you with a final concept to mull over.
This raises an important question, building directly on the text's assertion that rational actors will only provide so much information before they walk away. I want you to think about the invisible ticking clock that exists in every single professional interaction you have.
The ticking clock.
Since hindsight is 2020, I want you to evaluate your history. How many of your own past, missed opportunities, lost clients, or broken partnerships weren't actually due to a lack of skill or a fundamentally bad product?
But rather something else.
Exactly. How many of them failed simply because you failed to read the room and you miscalculated the exact silent moment the other side's patience expired?
Oh, wow.
And looking at your calendar tomorrow, where might you be taking someone's free interview? Their uncompensated time, their goodwill, or their patience completely for granted right now, pushing them inches away from declaring pens down on you.
That is a heavy but incredibly necessary diagnostic question to carry with you this week. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. As you go back to building your business, managing your team, or navigating your career, keep rigorously questioning your own perspectives. And remember that image we started with, the solitary rock climber on the sheer cliff face.
It's an illusion.
It turns out, if you zoom out far enough, you'll see an entire team of people holding the ropes, funding the expedition, and mapping the route. You just have to know how to read them, how to ask them for help, and exactly when to pull your own weight. See you next time.